Welcome to the Moose Room. Brad and Emily here today, finally together again. It's been a while.
Yes.
But we are excited to be here. And like I said last week, we've got lots of good guests coming up and lots of plans for the future. So we're here today and we actually have a guest today. It's been a long time since we've had a guest on the Moose Room. It's been, you know, sort of H5N1 all summer long. So we have not had many guests, but today we have a guest, Miranda Meehan from NDSU, North Dakota State University in Fargo. Hi, Miranda.
Hi.
Miranda is the Extension Livestock Environmental Stewardship Specialist there. And today we're going to talk a lot about some of her work that she's been doing in cover crop grazing. And what I'm excited about is virtual fencing. No, just learning a little bit about virtual fencing and how that goes. I think it's one of the hot topics in the livestock world right now is virtual fencing and how all that works. But before we get to that, we have two super secret questions.
The super secret questions, yes. And despite what Bradley may tell you, Miranda, there are no right or wrong answers to these questions. Just answer with your heart. All right. So your first question is, what is your favorite breed of dairy cattle?
That's, yeah, I've never thought about that one too much. probably the red and white are milking shorthorns.
Okay. So red cattle. Love that.
Yeah, I had Simmental growing up, so that's probably why.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
Awesome.
Okay, well, for those of you that we have kept up the list, but it's been a while since we've repeated it. So we'll go. It's Holstein 24, Jersey a little bit behind at 20, and Brown Swiss at 11, Montbéliard 3, Dutch Belted 3, Guernsey 3, shout out to Taffy still, Normandy 2, Ayrshire 2, and Milking Shorthorn Red and White 2. So we're gaining. The red cattle are gaining on us.
They are. All right. So you've probably figured out the second question, Miranda, which is, what is your favorite breed of beef cattle?
Oh, see, yeah, I'd have to go Simmental, or I really like Red Angus as well.
Okay.
Well, that's good.
Brad's okay with that. Yeah.
I'm okay with that. Yes. There's one breed that is the incorrect answer, but we won't throw them under the bus today. But it's been a while since we've had a Simmental one, so that's good. So, if you're keeping track,
I like to hear the difference. So,
hey, we love that here. Yes, and I know our beef list has a lot of ones and twos on it. So, Brad, why don't we run down those tallies quick?
Okay, here we go. It's a long list. Black Angus, 16. Hereford, 12. We are gaining on you. Black Baldy, 5. Scottish Highlander, 5. Charolais, 4. Red Angus, 4. Shorthorn, 3. Simmental, now 2. Belted Galloway, 2. Brahma, 2. And all with 1. Stabilizer, Galvey, Kiania, Nelore, Jersey, Belgian Blue, Brangus, Piedmontese, White Park, and Minish Scottish Highlander. So there are a lot of favorites in the beef world compared to the dairy.
Definitely. We all have our biases for sure.
Exactly. Yes. Of course.
Well, and I would say too, there are more beef breeds kind of used in the US than there are dairy breeds. So there's more to choose from. But
definitely.
Now that we're past
the correct question, the correct answer is Hereford.
Yeah.
We all know that. That is the correct
there
answer.
There are no correct answers, Bradley.
Okay. Well, I want to give Miranda's, like I said, from NDSU in Fargo. You know, it's just as cold in Fargo as what is it here in Western Minnesota today. But tell us a little bit about, you know, what your position is and what you do before we kind of get into talking about some of your research.
Yeah. So my position is majority extension, really looking at grazing systems, how do livestock interact with their environment, whether that's a traditional grazing system, integrated crop livestock is a lot of our work right now. I also do some riparian grazing management work. And just to be different, I have some reclamation work as well. out in Western North Dakota. So looking at brine impacted, pipeline impacted areas, and how do we get those back into production, whatever that might be. And I am also our extension disaster education coordinator. So it's been a little chaotic this last week with our wildfires in Western North Dakota.
So you know, actually something I just wanted to ask you about briefly, Miranda, since you specifically mentioned Western North Dakota, and I know there's been a lot of damage from wildfires. I've seen some pretty unfortunate photos of you know, cattle and their pastures that are really burned up. So just kind of curious, you know, from the livestock and maybe cattle grazing perspective out there, you know, how are things looking? Are we looking at a really long recovery? Are people going to be selling their cows because there's no grass? Just kind of curious if you have any sort of insight into what sort of conversations people are having right now in the wake of these wildfires.
Yeah, I think the biggest focus right now is still just kind of figuring out what the impacts are how many animals are lost, how many animals have been impacted negatively health-wise or will be, since we might have some delays until some of those things show up, with the smoke inhalation being one of our main concerns. Definitely some feed forage that is going to be negatively impacted, but with them being isolated, it's not a widespread impact either, except in those, I mean, some of the fires were large. We're up to probably around 120,000 acres that have burned in that part of the state. So I think the biggest thing we will see is kind of that, do we have enough feed to get through the winter, number one? And we're working to figure that out yet. And then the other thing is looking, like you said, what are the impacts for forage growth? With us being cool season dominant, and the timing of the fire is when our cool season grasses are putting up their tiller that they use to start growth the next spring, we're going to see a delay in growth because those plants are going to have to start over and re-put up that tiller. So with work being done, based off work that's been done in Miles City and some of the prescribed fire work that's been done, I think we'll be able to graze next year, but it's not going to be, we're not turning out in those pastures right away. So we're going to have to figure out a way to delay turnout. There is a lot of introduced grasses out there too, as in terms of crested wheatgrass pasture. So starting there, I think opportunity if people have had put in some annual forages, that starting on those, but it's going to vary greatly from operation to operation. What are their forage resources? A lot of this, a couple of the fires are mostly on Forest Service government lands and those leases. And so expecting a delay turnout or maybe a change in their rotation and when they're going to be able to start grazing into those areas that were impacted. And I don't know in terms of infrastructure and fences yet what that total impact looks like, our waters. And so we're going to have to think creatively potentially on grazing in some of those areas. In other states, and this is probably kind of leads into one of our other topics, is other states have used virtual fence in these situations, especially on federal land that has lost a lot of fences, to be able to get out animals out there and grazing, maybe exclude them from that area that was impacted, but still get them out and grazing the forage that is available.
So will producers in North Dakota have enough forage for the winter? Well, you know, or did a lot of it sort of burn up during the fires, or is it maybe in different parts of the state? Because, you know, here in Western Minnesota, we had plenty of rain, and in South Dakota, there was lots of rain. There was grass everywhere. Was it the same in North Dakota?
It depended where you were, as always. So Central and Eastern North Dakota during that early season, and even Western North Dakota is okay. So that's part of why we had the fires, is we had adequate moisture in the spring. And then August, September, things really dried out, except for an area in the north central part of the state. And so we had a fuel load that would support a fire. And so that's why we're seeing the damage and the extent of the fires that we did, is because of that fuel load available. So people did get, everybody was actually feeling pretty good about going into this winter overall, other than the western edge of the state had been experiencing drought. DE2 had been introduced in the last couple weeks, and so they definitely seen some forage production impacts there.
One thing that I found interesting is that you were maybe doing some work or trying to reestablish grazing lands in oil country in western North Dakota. How do you go about doing that? That's quite intriguing to, you know, for those of you that might not know, you know, western North Dakota has oil and it takes its toll on the land quite a bit. So how do you reestablish, how are you reestablishing grasses on that part of the world?
So we've actually done a few more novel things lately. Kind of developing tools is one thing we've been focusing on. So we worked with NRCS and Forest Service and some industry partners on areas they were having trouble with and identifying those areas and what are the soil properties in those areas. High salts is always one of the big challenges. And so we actually developed, it's programmed into Web Soil Survey, a reclamation suitability tool. And, you know, idealism, they avoid the areas that aren't suitable. But if they don't, and we actually are working with a couple companies that have adapted, they maybe can't avoid those areas. Maybe they'll directionally bore underneath them, or they're going to add some extra steps up front in their reclamation processes to help reestablish things in those harder to reestablish areas. Then based off of that, we also develop, and we're working on field testing some reclamation suitability or disturbance response groups. So once those soils are disturbed and mixed, they're going to respond differently than they do naturally. And we can group ones that we know respond similarly. So our clays and loams are going to respond similarly, a lot of the sands. And so we can refine the seed mixes, but still make it practical so that we don't have a seeding mix for every ecological site. We have it for a broader area. So we've narrowed it down to three different seed mixes. And then we have a native and a tame grass. So if it's pasture hayland versus if it was native area, that we have those recommendations for. So we're working to hopefully identify some sites we can field test on, but we haven't had that opportunity yet. Other things is just really the seeding methods is part of it and understanding how the soils respond. Big thing is compaction is really one of the huge issues. And so how can we help break up that compaction, or can we, our timing of, is there certain conditions we shouldn't be out on that right away working? And so if the soil is wetter, it might be more challenging because you're going to have more compaction. So we want to avoid disturbances at those times if possible. And then selecting the right plants, seeding methods. So if we're hydro, we've looked at things like hydro mulch versus straw pinning versus some other seed bed preparation. Straw pinning seems to be the best and actually most one of the more affordable ways that we've seen on some of our research. And we look at runoff and other pieces that follow up and seedling establishment as well. And so we're also doing that on some different types of slopes too, because high slopes are definitely more challenging to reclaim than something that's flat, like here in Fargo.
Right. So you know, grasses are very different, and you know, some of the listeners might not know some of those grasses, but it can be very different. And you know, when you get out on the prairie, you know, cows graze different things than brome grass, like a lot of the cows do here in Minnesota, in the north. So it's quite interesting. Let's talk about some of your research in crop and livestock integration. So I know you've posted some pictures online. You're doing some maybe warm season grazing this fall. How is that working out? And what sort of grass species are you using for that work?
Yep, we have a couple of different projects. One of our projects is actually cool season. We're doing some winter annuals. The goal is to graze fall and spring. We've actually only been able to graze in the fall one of 3 years so far. I don't know if we're going to this fall just because things got in late and it's been dry. We haven't got any moisture since our winter annuals went in. But we've gotten so many questions on what is the impact of fall grazing my rye on the stand the following year. The year we did it, no impact. And so we're hoping to answer that question. But I think it's
no. Will you graze? So you're grazing the rye mm-hmm. in the fall, and
if you can,
and are these farmers, are they grazing the rye in the spring, or is this letting it grow to seed in the spring?
Great question. Yep. It would be grazing in spring here, not for seed production. It's, we don't see a lot of that dual use in terms of grazing and seed production in the Northern Plains, partially because of our short growing season is really challenging. And so that was the question we were looking to answer. I think there's a potential there, but it has to be following the right crops. So we're going to have to be following a cereal of some sort that comes off early so we can get time to get that winter cereal established and have enough there to graze in the fall and then be able to graze that again in the spring. So right now, most people graze in those type of resources in the spring, but not necessarily in the fall.
So when would you plant, say, your rye in the fall? Are you talking like July, mid-July,
early August? No, we're probably, we planted in September.
Okay.
First part of September this year. It was first spread of October. We was following silage corn. And so
okay.
It was a little later. So we won't be able to probably graze this fall because of the conditions and how late it got in.
And have you been using rye for this so far, Miranda? Is rye the only crop you've looked at so far?
So far, we've done 2 years with rye. This fall, we put in 3 different winter cereals. So we put in rye, triticale, and winter wheat. And, so trying to look at if there are there differences in those species, especially on that spring side. And we're following them with a corn cash crop, trying to answer some of those questions about yield leg drags that we see when we follow corn behind some of these, that it's hit or miss, and the research is all over the place on that. So seeing what we see can find out for here in North Dakota.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think back about some of the research that I did a long time ago with grazing winter rye and winter wheat. It was sort of, you know, this was almost 10 years ago when I did that, but it was like nobody was ever doing that. So it was kind of one of those crazy ideas, like, what, you're going to graze winter wheat or winter rye? Who's doing that? And so we just did it and started it. And actually, I don't know, it seems the winter wheat was good too. I you know, a lot of people are stuck on rye because it grows so well. And I think it works well. And we still graze some winter rye here for our dairy cow herd, but I think there's other crops that can be used too besides winter rye, and so that's good that you're trying some new ones to see what can work well for farmers. I think we all get sort of stuck on this one thing. Nothing against rye, it's good, it's great forage, but I think there's other options,
which is helpful. It's not as big of an investment. I think one thing we've seen with the differences in just some of our plot trials is, so not necessarily grazing, but looking at quality and growth patterns there, is the rye is ready earlier, and the winter wheat that we have the most success with here, the Willow Creek, that it grows a little slower. So it's actually ready later in the spring. It's more of a late May, early June, where our rye starts growing as soon as conditions allow it to. So I think it kind of depends what you're looking for in your system too, and what fits there as to what you select.
So what about summer annuals? Are you grazing any summer annuals too? What's working in North Dakota?
Well, the other project we're doing, our goal was to hay and graze this fall. We didn't have enough growth at one of our sites to hay this summer to get the regrowth we needed to graze this fall. But that one, we have a 4-way mix. We have a forage oat, a forage pea, sorghum sedan, and the Paja turnip as a brassica in there. And so the goal would be that in that when we hayed, it would be a dominant more of the oats and spring and the pea, and then some sorghum sedan, but that would really pop after we hayed in July, hopefully getting regrowth to graze in this fall. But our one site just didn't have enough growth to be able to hay, and so we couldn't hay this year. Hopefully it works out a little better for us next year.
So you're actually haying the oats and peas with it, and then the sorghum sedan is there, but it's, you're hoping that it will grow afterwards.
Yeah.
So that's an interesting fact, because that's, you know, we don't necessarily hear about a lot of those ways of making hay or grazing as well here in parts of the Midwest, obviously. But yeah, maybe that's an interesting way to do things. And, you know, I think most of us here, and at least in the farmers that I've worked with, it's just a straight monoculture of sorghum grass or pearl millet, and not trying to sort of, you know, maximize forage production across the year. So that, so you're haying and then grazing in the fall in the same fields.
Yeah. So one thing, some of the feedback we got when we were doing only a winter or a warm season and grazing in the fall, so having a full season cover crop, was that it's hard to convince somebody to give up a crop. So if we can have a hay crop, then we're still getting two crops off of that and getting the grazing. And so economically, that's just more feasible for somebody to try something like that than having a cover crop sit there all summer just to graze in the.
It's all focused on livestock, right? It's focused on livestock feed. And I've tried to, in my own work, I've tried to drill into people that cover crops are for livestock and grazing. And, you know, cover crops have actually kind of, in my mind, and people might get excited when I say this, but at least out here in Western Minnesota, maybe it's been just the year, but they've kind of fallen out of favor a little bit because of increased cost for production agriculture. So people have sort of not used cover crops as much as what they have in the past, but most of these farmers don't have livestock. So I think if you had livestock, you'd probably see a lot more cover crops on the land.
That's something I'm just kind of hearing as I'm listening to you is this idea of kind of looking at multiple avenues to use this. Because I think, Brad, that's kind of what you were just hitting on with that too, is like, yeah, I think cover crops are kind of maybe going down a little bit in the state. And I just know in conversations I've had, that's because, yeah, people are kind of like, well, what is the point? I don't get how to use them. And yeah, I think it's because in some cases they maybe don't have livestock or don't have a connection to livestock to use it that way. And don't get me wrong, I'm a proponent. I think cover crops do a lot for soil health. So even if you're not a livestock person, I think there's benefits there. Just Emily's personal opinion. But I'm just really liking what you're saying, Miranda, is you're kind of looking at a few different options, right? We're grazing, we're haying, we're, you know, looking at different seasons. And that's where I see this, I think, just being more applicable, is we just need to see, like, it is not, you are just doing this and just using it this way, but you're really exploring multiple options to make it fit within whatever that livestock system is.
Yeah. Well, and I think, as we know, with working with livestock and working in grazing systems, there's no one size fits all. And so what works for one person isn't going to work for the other. So, and everybody has different grazing resources available for them. So how can we use cover crops to fill some of the gaps they have in those grazing resources is how I kind of look at things. And I think the research, I mean, we're looking at the soil health side too. So how can we manage those grazing animals within our cover crop systems to further enhance soil health? But I think when we look at just soil health, it's really hard to see that return. It takes a long time. It's there, I think, over the long run, but in our environments, with our moisture conditions, our short growing season, it's going to take 5+ years to see some of those benefits. Where if we have livestock, at least we're getting an economic return on that investment in that cover crop because we're getting forage out of it. And our research shows we've looked at, you know, taking none of that cover crop and just leaving it as a control on graze. Taking a take half, leave half approach. So a 35% harvest efficiency, and then a 50% harvest efficiency, which is really taking almost everything out there for grazing. And we've seen no differences in soil health benefits between those treatments. So might as well get as much forage out of it, in my opinion, and still maintain some cover because the cows aren't going to graze all the way to the ground. And so you still have some cover, some things holding that soil there. But we're getting more forage and get a bigger return out of that investment in that cover crop.
So let's talk a little bit about virtual fencing. I think, you know, most farms have heard about it, and, you know, it's like, well, what is this? Is it just letting your cows roam free on the land and somehow some magical, you know, laser keeps the cows in the fence? At least this is what people imagine.
Well, yes, because for me, I'm thinking of like invisible fencing for dogs, right? Like when I hear virtual fencing, that's the first place my mind goes. And I don't think it's totally that, right? But I imagine there's probably some similar concepts there and not having to have physical fencing up, because we know, especially in a grazing context, I know plenty of people that, you know, they spend half their lives moving fences around. So yeah, tell us a little more. And you mentioned the use of virtual fencing potentially being useful in emergency situations like what we're seeing with the fires in Western North Dakota. So yeah, tell us more.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is one of the fun things I get to talk about lately that we're doing. We've been doing work a couple of years and there's definitely a lot of interest, but a lot of unknowns in how do we use it. Very similar to the invisible fence for dogs, and actually they do have dog fences now that are GPS instead of having to have that line underground. And so the cows wear a collar, and then within a online platform or app, you're going to put your boundaries in where you want to keep those animals. It's not accurate enough that you wouldn't need a perimeter fence. You still need a perimeter fence. It's to better and more efficiently use those, manage those animals within that existing fence structure. Definitely not accurate enough to keep them in. And I wouldn't trust it that way, just because there's GPS errors, or like we've seen this spring up in this area with the electromagnetic or solar storms that we had, that GPSs went down. And so technology doesn't always work, but we've had some really, really good luck. Most of the research that's been done with those with our virtual fences is 90% or greater containment. There are, just like any other fence, though, there's cows that don't train as well to it, don't obey, and they're going to be a challenge. But overall, our response has been positive. So then when we put that border into the app, there's either through cellular data or a radio tower that data is communicated to the collar that those animals are wearing. And then within that collar, it reads the location of that animal, the location of the fence. And when they become so close to the fence, they will first receive an audio cue for most of them. Some of them will have a vibration instead, just depends what company, what product you're using. And then they will receive an electrical cue. And it's actually pretty low. It's about a quarter of a normal electric fence. So it is 800 volts. It's not much of a shock, but they learn it and they want to avoid it, is what we've seen overall.
The collar, how big is it? And what does it weigh? You know, they're people envision.
So they can't show it.
Is it a couple pounds? Is it this, you know, because some people envision this huge thing hanging around a cow's neck, and it's like, yeah. Is it worth having this big contraption around a cow?
Yeah, so that depends a lot on the company and product you're using. We have been using the Vence product, not that we are endorsing that product, but it was the only one on the market when we started our research. That one's a couple pounds. It's not very heavy. It's a housing that's probably about 6 inches by 4 inches. And then it's on a chain, and that's where the electrical stimuli is, comes through that chain that's around the animal's neck. They don't, once it's been fitted, they seem to be pretty comfortable. We don't put them on calves, because they're growing so fast that we would have to continuously go out, recapture, adjust. So it depends on your grazing period. We put them on growing animals, but those have been shorter trials, where they've only been grazing a month to 2 months. And on our other trials, they've been on mature cows, cow-calf pairs. The other one that's commercially available now, the E-Shepherd, is much bigger, because it has a solar battery and it solar recharge, where the Vence one has a lithium battery that lasts 5 to 6 months, so it can die on you. But the Gallagher one's heavier, and it has a rubber around where it would attach to the bottom at the bottom of the neck to make it more comfortable for the animal. and then at the top of the neck as well. So we're not, it's not rubbing too much and getting, they're not getting abrasions, but then it does have the chain as well to give that electrical stimuli through. But the Gallagher ones are much heavier, probably around 5-6 pounds, I'd say, almost double that of the Vents ones.
So you can say set the fence up. So if you set the boundaries, but can you set sort of break fences in there so you can maybe turn off one section so the cows, you know, can the cows move by themselves if you make this all planned out right? Is that the beauty of it?
Ideally, so there are three different types of fences you can create. An inclusion fence to keep them inside an area, an exclusion fence to prevent them from going in an area. Things I think that could be used for is if you had like blue-green algae or a water source, or you're trying to manage some type of habitat, you could keep them out of that area. A movement fence that you can use to push them through. So if you're trying to mimic a rotational grazing system, you could have those inclusion fences set up to turn on and turn off, and then have a movement fence to move them through into that next area. One herd can have up to 16 fences applied to it at any given time. And so you can have that all scheduled out to move. And one nice thing about it is it's very flexible. Like, you can adjust fences quickly. You can go in and move things around or add another fence. So one of our trials in Western North Dakota, we had, they were up against a fence that wasn't great, an existing fence. And there was a winter wheat field there that they decided to check out. So we then put a virtual fence there to help them stay where they're supposed to stay. So there's different scenarios that you can actually put a fence in and keep them where you want them.
So the question I have, and I feel like our listeners probably have it too, right? And you probably get this question, Miranda, right? And that's around cost. And you know, I get every company's going to be a little bit different. And so I'm just thinking, like, if I was going to purchase this, right? Like, how does that look? Is it a thing where, like, you are buying the software and then separately buying the individual collars you need? Like, if you're new to this, how do you kind of get set up, and what sort of costs should we maybe be thinking this might be?
Yeah, absolutely. That is the most common question I get after how it works and if it works. So the two, I'm just going to talk about the two that we have commercially available in our region. There are a couple other products coming that will be available this spring. It's very different depending on product. So the Vents collars, they need a base station. So they run off of a low RAN radio tower. And so you have to have a gateway base station. The cost of that low RAN base station is $10,000. If you want the company to come out and put it up for you, then you have an additional $2,000, which we did for our first one, so we knew what we were doing. And then after that, we built our other three that we have. The Vents collars are not purchased, they're leased. And so it's really nice in terms of that the technology is improving and changing so fast that we can always get updated collars if we want. They replace broken ones, they replace lost ones. And so that's been really nice. And that lease it's $40 a year. And then the battery is $10. So depending on how you're using it, you either have one battery or two batteries annually. The Gallagher product is you're buying the collar. The collar is $250. They do have a base station option depending if you don't have good cell coverage. Their base station is $5,000. But otherwise, you're paying for cellular data for that collar. And so when you look at this across a herd of 500, which just as an example, over a 5-year period, it's between $75 and $80 a head, depending on the product. And so 5 years picked just because that's how long the collars are expected to work that long in terms of the Gallagher. We don't know. Nobody's been using them long enough here to know that. The Vents towers are estimated to last 10 years. But again, nobody's had anything up and running that long to know what does wear and tear look like on them. We invest another $5,000 in each of our base stations to put them on a trailer so that they're mobile and we have flexibility to move them around between different areas that we're grazing so that we can get good coverage on those areas and that the towers is able to communicate with the callers on those animals.
So like any other precision technology, it's not cheap, you know?
No, but neither is a real fence anymore. So Dr. Ryan Reuters at Oklahoma State actually has developed a calculator where you can put in the costs of building a physical fence and compare it to the East Shepherd collars and the Vence collars. And it's pretty similar.
Well, that's good to know because, yes, I know here in our grazing dairy, nobody likes to make fence. It's time consuming, you know, and wire is expensive, posts are expensive, all of that, which you need, you know, if you have a perimeter fence, but even the brake fences and poly wires and everything else is, you know, the costs keep going up with that. So maybe there is an option for a virtual fence in the future. I think, you know, a lot of farmers are interested in this. Obviously they're scared because, you know, it's like, well, do I really trust this collar to make my cows not end up on the state highway like they have here? But I guess it's a new technology that will only keep getting better. And I think we'll probably start seeing more virtual fence into the future. I don't, you know, it's really started in the beef world. There's, you know, I don't know of any dairies that are using virtual fencing right now, but you never know in the future where that might lead.
Yeah, I think we have a couple of producers in the state that have been using it as part of different programs with some of our conservation groups. If they're grazing conservation lands, Ducklands Unlimited, for example. But that's really where we're at in the state. I do know in the next year that NRCS is going to start cost sharing it. And so I think there's more opportunities for people to try it with that available assistance.
And, you know, I will just say as a safety person, I like this idea. Something you said before, Miranda, was like, yeah, maybe you notice like there's some blue-green algae in your water so you can keep them away from that. And I think, yeah, there's a fire or even we know about some predators nearby and we can kind of make, you know, those decisions on the fly and kind of be changing and adapting as we go. And again, I'm viewing this really from a safety perspective right now of just like, you know, that's the number one thing we struggle with is having a fast response. And this, I see a faster response, right? You can push a few buttons on a computer or your smartphone a lot faster than you can go move wires around, you know? So yeah, I see a lot of benefits to it. I think it's really, really interesting. And I will say, and maybe that's just my perspective, I thought the cost was going to be higher. When you said those numbers, I'm like, okay, like it's going to cost something. It's new technology, right? You have to invest in that. But yeah, I see this and it'd be really interesting. I wonder if we can maybe find that calculator you were talking about from Oklahoma State to put in the show notes.
I can send you the link for it. Yeah.
It'd be awesome. Yeah. Cause I think I would just encourage people to maybe look at that and think more about that. And right. It's just like maybe having that more instant change, although it's going to cost more for some farms that might work better. You know, I just, yeah, there's a lot to consider with this.
Just like any other system, how does it fit into your operation? Where are the opportunities for you to use it? So when I talk to people here, is if you already have well-established cross fence in a grazing system, probably not the time for you to try this unless you have different resources that you're going to utilize it in, such as grazing cover crops, where you don't want to put those fences up to use them more efficiently. If you're at that point where you need to replace fence or you're installing new fences, I think this is a great opportunity to try it. And I think the flexibility is wonderful. Also, I think there's just a lot of opportunities we haven't looked into yet for using it. Like bale grazing, I think would be fantastic not to have to move those fences when it's you're freezing cold out and you can't move them or they're buried. We have that. You can't bury a virtual fence. And so I think there's some really cool opportunities that we still need to test out here. So we have been using the virtual fence in cover crop system this year. And it's worked beautifully to manage those animals to strip graze it. A couple sites, it didn't work as well because there's a training period and those animals didn't train as well because of the pasture we trained them in, I think, was too narrow. And so they were coming in contact with the cues and learned to ignore the cues instead of obey them. So there's definitely some logistical things you have to figure out with adapting any type of technology, including virtual fence. But if you want to keep up with it, feel free to follow myself on Facebook, X, LinkedIn. We've been putting updates on of our research and how it's been working for us.
And we'll be sure to put those links in our show notes page so everybody can check them out. So I think it's good. I think we've learned a lot about cover crops and grazing and a little bit of interesting tidbits about grazing in North Dakota, which is always quite interesting, and virtual fence. So thanks, Miranda, for joining us today. And Em, why don't you wrap us there, right?
All right. I think that is a great place to wrap it. Thank you again, Miranda, for coming. I think Brad and I both learned a lot, and hopefully our listeners did as well. I think we're going to see a lot of increase in searches for virtual fencing would be my guess. But with that said, if you have questions, comments, or scathing rebuttals about today's episode, you can email those to newsroom@umn.edu. You can also call and leave us a voicemail at 612-624-3610. Find us on the web, extension.umn.edu, and you can find Bradley on Instagram at umnwcrocdairy. And that's a wrap.